In 1990, the biggest movie hit of the year was a film called Ghost, starring Patrick Swayze, Demi Moore, and Whoopi Goldberg. It was nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards that year and won Oscars for Whoopi Goldberg as Best Supporting Actress and Bruce Joel Rubin for Best Original Screenplay for writing Ghost. It's a film he's very proud of, especially now, 25 years later, when the musical version of the movie is opening on Australian stages. I had the great pleasure of talking to Bruce Joel Rubin about Ghost and about the extraordinary journey it's taken him on. The reviews for Ghost the musical have been fantastic so far in Australia. What do you make of that?
You know, it's a wonderful show, and a lot of people appreciate it. People come to the theater hoping it to deliver something like the movie delivered, and they get that and more. And they walk out raucously happy. I mean, and sad, because, you know, it has a very sad ending. But at the same time, you are so filled with the fullness of the experience. It's a play or a musical that makes you laugh and makes you cry. And that's something that people want. It's a full-blown experience. It's not an hors d'oeuvre, it's a meal.
I would guess most of the people coming to the show would have seen the film or be aware of it, and so you have that name recognition immediately. But do you also have to get over the fact that a lot of people think, oh, not another musical based on a movie?
Probably more now than before. That is the case, I think. And, you know, some musicals are rehashes of old shows done for people who think there's some money to be made. And some are done because they are passionate about giving this another life. And I have to say that for me, I didn't want to do it. I fought it for a very long time. And then these two extraordinary producers came to my house in upstate New York and started to sell me on their version of the show. And I started looking at what they were saying and going, this is interesting. And they stayed so long, they actually missed their train back to the city. So they slept over that night and we talked into the night. And by early morning, I was committed to it, primarily because in the movie, you have something called a close-up. In a musical, you have a song. And a song is what brings you deeply into the story and the character. And it was exciting for me to explore things in the musical that I couldn't really fully, deeply explore in the movie. So it wasn't like a retread. It really was like a new approach to, a new experience of what Ghost is.
Giving it a second life is like the character, isn't it?
Well, that's wonderful to say that. Yes. No, it's very much... It is a rebirth or a haunting, if you will, of our experience because, you know, in a sense, the movie is over. It's finished. It's no longer with us as anything but what it was. This is to give it a life with new energy, new people, new actors. And it is shocking to see how effective it is with new people playing these parts. You think it will be, oh, we'll miss Patrick, we'll miss Demi, we'll miss Whoopi. They are like ghosts behind the scenes of the people who are now speaking to you. And very quickly, you begin to forget that they were there because you're so involved with who is in front of you.
During the commentary of the DVD of the movie version of Ghost, you make the remark that one of the reasons that Ghost was successful is that it was a comedy, it was a drama, a thriller, a mystery, a romance, a ghost story, everything except a musical. And then you say, maybe that's how we can remake it. So was it always in your mind that maybe this might be a musical?
Not in a serious way. I couldn't imagine how they would do it on stage, first of all. I mean, it seems like such a big production. How do you have people walking through walls, you know, and appearing and disappearing? How do you do that? I really didn't have a clue to that. Luckily, we ended up with a director who was an amateur magician, and he knew exactly how to do it. And he brought a level of technical expertise and brilliance and visual flair to the show I never imagined it would have.
Do you remember making that remark in the
commentary? No, not at all. No, you're the first person who's ever said that to me. I'm fascinated by it. That's really intriguing. But I was probably right. The only thing I could imagine, even sitting here now, is the only thing you can do to Ghost other than what we had done was have people sing and dance.
When did the idea emerge that the movie would have this life beyond the screen and onto the stage and it would be a musical? It was, you say, when these two people came and approached you about that. How long ago was that?
About 10 years ago. It was a long time after the show, after the movie came out. I had been approached by a fair number of people and kept saying, no, I'm not interested. I see no upside. It seemed to me that the great problem was that it would be done badly and it would be left really as a sad memory of what the movie had been. And I was very worried about that. But once I had decided to embrace this and really go after it, that was ennobling on some level. It excited me. Excited me enough to write 22 songs, which I've never written a song in my life. And I didn't do the music because I'm not musical, but the songs were actually fairly good. And when we actually got we got composers. We have two composers for this show working in tandem, and Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics, Glenn Ballard, who is the producer for Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill and songs with Michael Jackson. And these were amazing guys, and they took all of my 22 songs and wrote the most beautiful music for them. It was like if I could have imagined the music that would have emerged, it would be what they had written. And for a while, in the early version of the show, there were 22 of my songs there. And then when we hired our director, Matthew Warchus, he came to me very kindly, and he said, you know, Bruce, your songs are really good, but we have two of the best songwriters in the world here. Why don't we give them a shot? And I couldn't say anything, but of course. And so he did, and one song after another of mine left the show. And it was really sad on one level, but on another level, the songs we got in replacing my songs were wonderful.
Do any of the words of your songs remain?
Yes, and four songs, they're okay. Still my words, but everything else is really Dave and Glenn. And you probably, if you see the show, could tell the difference. Their songs are better. They're just better than mine. Mine, on the other hand, still have a certain kind of relevance to the show, and they're good.
Given that it was your idea in the first place to write this script, and that you were so much a part of the movie, far more than a lot of director-writer collaborations, how difficult was it to hand it over to somebody else and say, rightio, you take it from here?
I did do that, but with a caveat, and that I said, I want to be around for the whole thing. That I was not invited to be, I wasn't really wanted there, but I couldn't allow this experience to happen without me having it. You know, it was too big. I love theater. I love musical theater. I didn't want to be absent from it. So I said, I would like to be a presence here. I don't have to be a verbal presence. I just need to be someone who sits and watches it happen.
This is just like Patrick Swayze in the movie.
In a way.
Or the character.
It is. And so the director said, okay. And as I have said to many people, they put me at the far end of the furthest table in the room of the rehearsal sessions, and I didn't say a word. But interestingly, and I don't know how or why, my silence became an attractor of a lot of energy from people. And people would come over to me, actors, dancers, and just hug me. They'd walk in the room in the morning, and the first thing they would do is come over and give me a hug, and then they would go to work. And I became like a little touchstone for it. And after a while, I was loud, if you will, a voice in what was happening, and then I became very trusted as part of the project.
What can you do on stage that you can't do on film? Because in a way, sometimes the stage is the limiting thing, and you can do anything at all in a movie. What can you do on stage that you can't do in a film?
In general, there is something I call the proscenium arch effect, where you sort of leave your body, and the actor leaves the stage, and somewhere in the middle you connect in this invisible way. It's almost like what happens when you read a book. In a movie, it's different because a movie pulls you in. It sucks you in. There's no barrier. You're just there. But the dance in theater is between you and what is happening on that stage. It's very personal. It's very powerful. And I've always, theater for me was my first love. It's still, in a way, my first love. And also, it's living and breathing, whereas a film is inert. It's done. It's frozen forever in time and space. Theater is not. It goes on. And that I love.
What were you able to do in the musical now that you weren't able to do in the film? You would have had to make a lot of compromises in order to get that vision to the screen. Having another go at it to get it on stage, what were you able to bring to it that you thought, I really wanted to do that the first time around?
One thing is that the story is the story, and the plot is very heavily plotted. So I couldn't change the plot, and so much of the character and dialogue services that plot. So I couldn't really make it a different show, nor did I want to, as a successful show. So what I did do was take out elements that were in the show that could be elaborated and made them into songs, and those songs started to deepen, elaborate elements of the character that I could not express in the movie. And I found that, not that it made it better, but that it was so interesting to be able to hear their thought process, their thinking, their emotional life, not just see it as in an image, but to actually enter into it. And that excited me.
People will want to know whether the song Unchained Melody is in this show, is it?
Of course.
Okay. It's amazing when you listen to that song, how beautifully it fits, obviously, in the movie and in the stage. It could have been written, just the whole idea of hunger for your touch, which is what these people want to do after he's died. How did the song get into the movie in the first place?
Jerry kept saying, we need a song for this movie to play on the jukebox when they dance. And, you know, we all kind of, Chris, really thought about what could be the song. Lisa Weinstein, who was the producer, walked into the office one day and said, I have the song. And she brought her little tape recording box with her, and she set it down. She pushed the button on the play button, and all of a sudden, Unchained Melody came on, and every one of us got shivers going straight up our spine. And we said, of course, how could it not be that?
A long, lonely time.
You name it. The melody, the words were written for Ghost, and they just were. And it's become my theme song in a way. And I mean, I just had breakfast with my wife in a coffee shop, and that song, as soon as I walked in, started playing. It's like, I don't know what that's about, but it was like, I have this musical connection to something so sweet and so beautiful. And that song is like a gift. And when it plays for people nowadays who know the movie, and there are a lot of people who do, it gives them that moment. And it's a rich, rich moment.
It's the most played song, I think, in the history of American radio.
Oh, that I didn't know. That's very interesting.
Partly, I think, because, obviously, it was a huge hit, number one hit back in the 60s, and then revived in 1990 because of the film.
You know, we found the version that spoke to us, and in the play, it comes across a number of times kind of unexpectedly, and I love the way that works.
Bruce Joel Rubin is our guest, and he wrote Ghost. He won an Oscar for it as well. We'll get to that in a second. He's written the book and four of the songs, as you've heard, for the stage musical, Ghost the Musical, which is on in Australia. The movie, or the story, obviously the play as well, or the musical as well, is really about people who aren't what they appear to be, isn't it? A man who is dead, but he's not really. There's a friend who's not really a friend. There's a psychic who isn't. There's a widow who's not really a widow. You're kind of telling two stories at once, aren't you?
You know, I mean, I never thought about it that way, but yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the great things about all fiction is, you know, when there's layering and depth to characters when it's not completely straightforward. And I think one of the strengths of Ghost is that it takes this world of invisible reality and it makes it not only visible, but tangible. And people feel something that is in their psyche, kind of hoping and praying that it's true, that we somehow survive the thing we think of as potentially annihilating. And I think that we're drawn into people who are in involvement with that reality, you know, and all of these characters are deeply involved with the passing of this man, and yet they are all connected to his still very visible presence. There's something very satisfying of our deep inner quiet longing to know that this is true.
It's also an actor who doesn't interact with some of the other characters.
Right, which is why it was so hard to get anyone to play that character.
Yeah.
Because all these actors would say to us, why would I want to do that? You know, plus he's dead. Why would we want to be this disempowered figure? You know, and it was like, they kept turning us down, you know. I mean, Harrison Ford said, I've read it twice, I still don't get it. Tom Cruise said, definitely no. Paul Hogan was one of the first people we wanted for this show, and he as well turned it down.
Interesting you mentioned Paul Hogan, because he was on the Barbara Walters special, and it was screened in Australia because of Paul Hogan, who was huge at the time here. Obviously, he's a big star in Australia, but because of Crocodile Dundee. And that was the interview that Barbara Walters did with Patrick Swayze that got him the role.
That's right.
He was on the same special.
You've done your homework.
Well, I remember watching it at the time and how he was talking about his dead father. Well, Barbara Walters brings up the fact that Patrick Swayze's father has died, and he tears up and says, you caught me off guard. And that was the moment, wasn't it, that thought, hang on a minute, he could be Sam.
That's when I knew that he was Sam. But I tell this story, and Jerry gets very upset that I tell it, but Jerry was not looking.
Jerry Zucker, who's the director.
Yes, that he did not want Patrick Swayze in this movie, and I won't go into all of it, but he was pretty vocal about it. And I said, we had no one left to do the movie. Paramount was about to turn it down. Kevin Kline was going to be approached one more time because even though he had said no, we saw there was maybe an opening. But I just saw Patrick tear up about his father, and it was the most masculine tearing up I have ever seen in my life, and he broke my heart. And I just said, he has to be it. So I did a lot of subterfuge. Jerry didn't know about it until that recording that you heard on the disc. That's when I finally admitted it out loud, that I had gone behind his back to contact Patrick's agent to tell her to have Patrick offer to come in and audition. And then she did. And Jerry said, Bruce, you're not going to believe what's happening. Patrick Swayze is asked to audition for this movie. I said, well, then you have to let him do that. He said, well, yeah, I guess I do. And so I called Nicole again, his agent, and said, here are the parts he should read. Here's what he should do. Tell him to wear a suit, carry a briefcase, da-da-da-da-da. I had her do all this stuff. And then he came in and he was a banker. He was what we thought he could never be. And then he delivered the last lines of the film, which, you know, the love inside, you take it with you. And we were crying. The whole room of us were crying. And it was like, not only did he have the part, he saved the movie because it would have been totally canceled by Paramount.
It's an amazing thing, isn't it, that people now think, well, it could only be Patrick Swayze, Whoopi Goldberg, who won an Oscar, and Demi Moore. It could have been Nicole Kidman, Tina Turner, and Kevin Klein, or Paul Hogan.
Not Tina Turner. She auditioned for us, and I have to say, she
was... if she was your last chance, you might have had to have taken
it. Well, you know, if that had happened to be a problem, she just couldn't. She'd made Oda Mae a person I wouldn't want to watch on screen. I mean, I love Tina Turner, but she did not deliver that part. We interviewed and auditioned everybody. Whoopi was the character. It could have been different people, yes. Yeah. It would have been a different movie, yes. But the movie that happened, I don't think it could ever have been other than what it became.
There was one role, I think, that was fairly easy to cast, and that was the nun in the street.
Yes.
Who was that?
My mother.
And did she do a good job?
People roared with laughter when she got the check for, in those days, $4 million and fainted dead away. It was so funny because Jerry puts his mother in the movie, his father in the movie, his sister in the movie, everybody in the movie. And I kept saying, well, can I put my dad in the movie? He said, Bruce, the director gets as many of his family as he wants. The writer gets his mother. And that was it.
In Hollywood, the writer is generally the low man on the totem pole, but it seems as though in this film that your collaboration with Jerry Zucker, who's best known for directing with his brother and Jim Abraham, Flying High, we call it in Australia, Airplane Elsewhere, and these kind of wacky comedies, that you and he worked so closely together. Why did it work so well?
Well, let me say two things. We are not the bottom of the totem pole as writers in Hollywood. We are the part that's stuck in the ground. We're the thing that holds it up, that makes it possible for it to stand, but we are invisible in the process. Jerry Zucker and I had dinner when I found out he was going to be interested in, but more likely, directing Ghost. And I said, we can talk about anything but Ghost. That was my ground rule. And we started talking, and we talked for 3 hours, and we became friends that we remain today. That was essential. He had no directorial ego. He was not threatened by my presence. He felt that he was able to benefit from the writer's vision. We spent a year rewriting the script together, not in ways that made me happy at first. We did 19 drafts in the end, 10 of which got worse and they went further and further away from what it was intended. He recognized that, and then we slowly brought it back. And when it came back to where it had started, it was a much better version of where it had started. And we became close friends.
Lest people forget, it was the biggest grossing film of 1990, one of the biggest grossing films of the 1990s, and was nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. After its huge success, and I went to see it twice when it came out, when it first came out, did some of the people who had turned you down or turned down the roles or who didn't think it was going to go anywhere come to you and say, we got it wrong?
No. The one person I would have loved to have done that was an agent who fired me just before I moved to Los Angeles, and I was now moving to Los Angeles with no agent. His words to me as he fired me were, and besides, nobody wants to make movies about ghosts. He never called me, but I would love to have heard him say he was wrong. Other than that, no, people don't do that in Hollywood. People make bad choices all the time. Yeah. Nobody knows. When the film was opening, before it opened, we were doing publicity tours, and I was in Detroit and went to a radio station or a TV station, and they said, oh, you did Ghost Dad, which was a Bill Cosby movie. And I said, no, actually, I did a movie called Ghost with Patrick Swayze, Whoopi Goldberg. And they looked at me like, oh, too bad. That's so, I wish you, too bad you hadn't done the big film, Ghost Dad. And three movies about ghosts were coming out at that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a funny period. But clearly, it was not perceived as a film that anybody would want to see. But that next day, I was in a theater in Detroit, and they were showing Tom Cruise's movie with Nicole Kidman.
Days of Thunder.
Days of Thunder, thank you. And we were sitting in the fourth row waiting for the preview of Ghost that was going to start after Days of Thunder. And we were very close up front, and the theater emptied out after Days of Thunder. And I thought, nobody wants to see Ghost. This is the most awful experience ever. And we're just sitting there, and we had about 30 minutes. And all of a sudden, I realized the front rows are filling up. And I didn't know why would anybody sit in the front row. And I turn around, and the whole theater is completely full. And they're telling people, please, you cannot sit in the aisles. It is not acceptable to sit in the aisles. And it's the first time I ever had an inkling that something was happening. And the opening night of Ghost, we were all in a van, all of the cast and a lot of us were in the studio people, and we all were driving to the various theaters that were opening in. And one in Westwood called the Bruin Theater, we were driving to the Westwood, and we saw this line about, I don't know, this huge line crossing streets. And we all said, what's that? You know, it made no sense because you never see lines like that. We got to the theater and we saw it was a line for the midnight showing that they had just added of Ghost. And it went four blocks. And I said, what? What? That was when we first had a feeling because the reviews were not great. The reviews were very mediocre. People wanted to see this and they kept going. And all I know is we opened July 13th, a Friday the 13th, which in America is bad luck. I don't know about here, but it was very good luck for us. In today's money, that film made for $28 million would have grossed what would be $1 billion. For a little $28 million Hollywood movie, it's unheard of. Why? I mean, it's a question we ask ourselves. Yeah. But we think it touched a nerve that people wanted to have touched.
At the Academy Awards, you're nominated for Best Original Screenplay. You're up against Peter Weir, the great Australian director, Barry Levinson, who's an Oscar winner himself, Woody Allen, legend, Whit Stillman, who wrote one of my favourite movies of all time, Metropolitan. I was cheering for him. Sorry, Bruce. You won the Oscar. I think it was Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins announced it. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about that moment, that whole night, when you're sitting in there thinking, Woody Allen, Barry Levinson, Peter Weir, and also a bloke who's written one of the great movies of all time, Metropolitan, Whit Stillman. Did you think, I'm going to win this?
I did not think I had a chance, and I thought Barry was going to win, because I loved his movie. It was Avalon, it was called. Yeah. It was so beautiful. And I really didn't know who would win, except I'd had dinner with some well-known screenwriters at Jerry's house, and they said, you're going to win, Bruce. And I said, well, how do you know that? They said, because yours is the only film that's also nominated for Best Picture. Mm. And that's the whole Academy nominating. So clearly people liked your film. And that's the only vague indication I had that maybe that was true, but I didn't really expect it. And the Writers Guild gave the award to Barry Levinson. So I was kind of not really thinking it would be me. I had been working on a speech since I was 8 years old, but unfortunately I couldn't remember any of it by that time. My name was called. And for some reason, I don't know why, I just reached over and shake Barry Levinson's hand after I kissed my wife. And then I walked up on stage, like, terrified on some level. But the speech was in my head, and I managed to deliver the speech. You know, I was just impressed that Jody and Sir Anthony Hopkins he wasn't Sir yet, no. were presenting it to me. And the speech came out just fine. And I had a spiritual teacher many years ago named Rudy, and at the last moment I wanted to thank him, which I did. I held up the statue and said, thank you, Rudy. And I walked off the stage and I knew my life had changed.
Where do you keep your Oscar?
When I came home from the Oscars, I put it on the nightstand next to my bed, and it has never left.
Is this now the end of your Ghost journey, now that the musical has been opening in so many different places and now in Australia?
Well, I thought so. But the people who are in charge of Ghost going out for amateur groups and colleges and universities have asked if we would do a chamber version that could be simplified, because most people cannot afford the magnitude of what this play is like on the big stage. I mean, it's such a huge, violently beautiful, big production and magic, real magic in it that happens. People can't do that. Can you even tell them how to do the magic? We can't do that. So how could we make this smaller? And what happened for me is the last run-through of the show before we got on a stage at the Gerwood Studios in London, we saw the entire production without a set, without the magic, with the music, with the dancing, and the whole show. And I have to say, it was the most moving version I ever saw. It had nothing to distract you from the core story. So yes, I'm going to be working on trying to bring in, to break the chamber version of the show, and we're going to do a test version of it in Pennsylvania this year, and we'll see if it works. And if it does, I think it will have yet another life. It's the same show. Mm-hmm. It's just producible in ways that the larger version is hard to do.
Finally then, I'm sure you must have been asked this many times, but I'll ask you, do you believe in ghosts? Have you ever had a ghostly experience or something that you can't explain? I know you're a very spiritual man because you spend a lot of time in, you know, Buddhist retreats and things like that.
You know, and I've been studying and practicing meditation and learning how to go inward, if you will. And I have had phenomenal experiences my whole life. ghostly experiences, kind of. When my mother passed away, I was in my brother's house crying in his bedroom, and I may have fallen asleep, I don't know, but it didn't feel like that. All of a sudden, my teacher, who had passed away, walked in the room, and I'm just looking at him. And then behind him was my grandmother, and then it was my mother who had just passed away. And they all walked into the room, and I just stared at them. And my grandmother came, and she laid on top of me and disappeared into me. And then my mother came and laid on top of me and disappeared into me. And then the room was empty, and I was just there in a state of, I can't even describe what it was, but the beauty of the immersion in their spirits, because they were extraordinary beings. And then the amazing thing that my teacher had brought them in the room, which was really like, what's that about? It was very powerful for me. I've had lots of experiences, lots. And I mean, you know, and we could do 20 interviews about that. I have no question and no doubt that we live before we're born and we continue after we're dead, that we live in a spectrum of existence that's beyond anything people will ever comprehend, that death is a doorway to something vast and very shockingly familiar. It's like my experience and having journeyed into those spaces is, oh, this again? And it's really powerful. And I walk around with a kind of knowing, which is not a belief at all. It's like, oh, it's experiential and it's known. And so for me, ghost comes out of that. It's a story from that, but it's just one of many stories that would emerge from that. And now I can't even tell stories anymore because I'm just, a story is one idea and I have too many ideas. So I teach a meditation class is what I do, and I have a lot of students.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, Bruce, and the very best of luck with the show.
Rod, this has been a really remarkable interview for me. Your level of preparation is unequaled, and I have to say, deeply moving to me, and your questions have a profound centeredness to them that I'm very grateful for. So thank you.
That is Bruce Joel Rubin talking about writing the movie Ghost, which is available on DVD, and in 2016, the musical version is on Australian stages.